She was here, safe. Maybe her entire family had fled, just before the FBI broke down their door, leaving them to find an empty house, the window open, curtains blowing in the wind. He'd never met them, but could picture them clearly, running down the alley, leaving the FBI agents flat-footed and confused. He walked around to the sitting area and felt his stomach drop, as if hitting the floor, rolling under the couch, lost somewhere. "You must be Henry. We've been waiting for you." An older Caucasian man in a fine tanned suit sat across from Henry's father. Sitting next to the man was Chaz.
"Sit, sit,"
Henry's father motioned, speaking Chinglish.
"Henry, I'm Charles Preston. I'm a building developer. I think you know Junior here. We call him Chaz, in our house anyway. You can call him whatever you want."
Henry had a few choice names, in two languages even. He waved at Chaz, who smiled so sweetly Henry noticed his dimples for the first time. Still, he didn't understand what was going on. In his own home, no less.
"What?
What are you doing here?" He thought it, but the words were stuck somewhere in his throat, as he realized why his father had worn his suit, the one he always wore to important meetings, that morning.
"Your father and I were trying to discuss a business matter, and he indicated you'd be a perfect translator. He says you're learning English over at Rainier Elementary."
"Hi, Henry." Chaz winked, then turned to his father.
"Henry's one of the smartest kids in class. He can translate anything. Japanese, too, I bet."
Those last words came out like mumbled ice cubes as Chaz once again beamed at Henry. Henry could tell Chaz didn't like being there any more than he did, but he was content playing cat and mouse with Henry while innocently seated at Mr. Preston's elbow.
"Henry? Mr. Preston owns several apartment buildings around here. He's interested in developing some property on Maynard Avenue in Japantown,"
his father explained in Cantonese.
"Since I'm a Chonghua board member, he needs my support and the support of the Chinese community in the International District. He needs our support for the approval of the city council."
He said it in a way, his tone, his eyes, his mannerisms, that made Henry realize this was a very big deal. Very serious, but also very enthusiastic. His father didn't get excited about too many things. Victories in China over the invading Japanese army, which were few, and Henry's scholarshiping at Rainier were the only things he'd ever talked about with such electric enthusiasm. Until now, anyway. Henry sat on the footstool between them, feeling small and insignificant, caught between a rock and another rock, two towering pieces of adult-shaped granite.
"What do I need to do?"
he asked in English, then in Cantonese.
"Just translate what each of us is saying, the best you can," Mr. Preston said.
Henry's father nodded, trying to follow the English words Chaz's father spoke slowly.
Henry rubbed grit and soot from the corners of his eyes, wondering about Keiko and her family. He thought about those three Japanese couples lying face down on the dirty floor of the Black Elks Club in their evening finery.
Being hauled out and jailed somewhere. He stared back at Mr. Preston, a man trying to buy land out from under families who were now burning their most precious possessions to keep from being called traitors or spies. For the first time, Henry realized where he was, standing on one side of an unseen line, between himself and his father, and everything else he'd known. He couldn't recall when he'd crossed it, and couldn't see an easy way back. He looked at Mr. Preston and Chaz, then at his father, and nodded.
"Go ahead. I'll translate. I'll do my best," he thought.
"Henry, can you tell your father that I'm trying to buy the vacant lot behind the Nichibei Publishing Company? If we can force the Japanese newspaper out of business, will he approve us to buy that land as well?"
Henry listened intently. Then he turned to his father, speaking in Cantonese.
"He wants to buy the land behind the Japanese newspaper, and the building, too."
His father evidently knew this area well, answering,
That property is owned by the Stame family. But the head of the family was arrested weeks ago. Make an offer to the bank, and they will sell it out from under them. The words came out slowly, presumably so Henry wouldn't miss a thing in translation. Henry was shocked at what he was hearing. He looked around for his mother. She was nowhere to be seen. Probably downstairs doing laundry, or making tea for the guests. He hesitated for a moment, then looked at Mr. Preston, and in all seriousness said,
"My father won't approve of the sale. It was once a Japanese cemetery, and it's very bad luck to build there. That's why the lot is empty."
Henry pictured a dive bomber, augering toward its target, loaded with ordnance. Mr. Preston laughed.
"He's kidding, right? Ask him if he's joking."
Henry could hardly believe that for the first time in months, he was actually talking to his father, and telling him lies. But necessary ones, Henry thought. He looked over at Chaz, who just stared at the ceiling, seemingly out of boredom. Henry's father was hanging on his every Cantonese word.
"Mr. Preston says he wants to turn the building into a jazz club. That kind of music is very popular, and there's a lot of money to be made."
Henry pictured his imaginary bomber releasing its payload, the bombs raining down. "Scree!" His father looked more offended than confused. Bullseye. The bombs exploded on impact. The International District needed many things, his father argued, but more nightclubs and more drunken sailors were evidently not very high on Henry's father's agenda for progressive community development, even if they displaced some of the Japanese in Nihomachi. The conversation went significantly downhill from there. Mr. Preston grew angry, accusing Henry's father of indulging in Japanese superstition. Henry's father accused Mr. Preston of indulging too often in the spirits that he intended to sell at his proposed jazz club. After more mixed translation on Henry's part, they ended their bilingual discussion, agreeing to disagree, each warily eyeing the other. But they still argued, bypassing Henry altogether, hardly understanding a word each other was saying. Chaz stared at Henry, not even blinking. He opened his coat and showed Henry the button he'd stolen from him. Neither parent noticed, but Henry saw. Chaz flashed him a buck-tooth grin, then closed his coat again, and smiled angelically as his father said,
"We're done talking about this. I can see coming here was the wrong thing to do. You people will never be able to handle real business anyway."
Henry's mother walked in with a fresh pot of her best chrysanthemum tea, just in time to see Chaz and Mr. Preston stand up and storm out, looking like gamblers who'd lost their last sawbuck on a round of pitch and toss. Henry took a cup of tea and graciously thanked his mother, in English. She didn't understand the words, of course, but seemed to appreciate the tone. After finishing his tea, Henry excused himself to his room. It was early, but he felt weary. He lay down, closing his eyes, and thought about Mr. Preston, the adult version of Chaz, greedily carving up Japantown, and his own father, so eager to help with these important business matters. Henry half expected to feel happy about disrupting their plans, but all he felt was exhausted relief and guilt. He'd never disobeyed his father so blatantly, but he had to. He had seen the fires in Nihomachi and people burning their prized possessions, ashen remainders of who they had been, who they still were. Boarded up storefronts with American flags in the windows. He didn't know much about business, but he knew times were tough and getting worse. He needed to find Keiko, needed to see her. As darkness fell, he pictured her in some family photograph, a portrait on fire, curling, burning, and turning to ash. Hello, Hello, 1942. When Henry finally opened his eyes again, He saw nothing but darkness. What time is it? What day? How long have I been asleep? His thoughts raced as he rubbed his eyes and blinked, doing his best to wake up. A sliver of moonlight peeked between the blackout curtains on his bedroom window. Something had woken him. What was it? A sound? Then he heard it again. A ringing in the kitchen. He stretched, reorienting once again to time and place, then rolled his feet to the cold wooden floor, sitting up. His eyes adjusting to the darkness, Henry could make out the silhouette of a serving tray in his room. His mother had thoughtfully left him dinner. She'd even put the vase with her starfire lily on the tray for simple decoration. There it was again, the unmistakable sound of their telephone ringing. Henry still wasn't quite used to its loud, jarring bell. Fewer than half of the homes in Seattle had telephones, and even fewer had them in Chinatown. His father had insisted on having one installed when the United States had declared war on the Axis powers. He was a block warden, and his responsibilities included staying in touch. With whom, exactly, Henry didn't know. The phone rang again, clanging like a wind-up alarm clock. Henry started to yawn, but froze part way as he thought about Chaz. He now knows where I live. He could be outside waiting for me right now. Waiting for me to come wandering out unawares, taking out the trash or bringing in the laundry. Then he'd pounce, getting even, without teachers and playground monitors to get in the way. He peered through the heavy, musty curtains, but the street, two stories below, looked cold and empty, damp from a recent rainstorm. In the kitchen, he could hear his mother answering, "Way? Way? Hello? Hello?" Henry opened his door, padding down the hallway toward the bathroom. His mother was mumbling something on the phone about not speaking English. She waved at Henry, pointing to the phone. The call was for him. Sort of. "Hello?" he asked. Henry was used to handling all the wrong numbers. They were usually in English, or calls from census takers polling the Asian community. Strange women, asking Henry how old he was, and if he was the man of the house.
"Henry? I need your help."
It was Keiko. She sounded calm but direct. He hesitated, not having expected Keiko's soft voice. He started speaking in whispered tones, then remembered his parents didn't speak English anyway.
"Are you okay? You weren't at school. Is your family okay? Can you meet me at the park? The park we met at last time?"
She was being vague, deliberately vague. Henry could talk freely, but obviously she couldn't. He thought about the operators who often listened in and understood.
"When? Now? Tonight? Can you meet me in an hour?"
An hour? Henry's mind raced. It's already after dark. What'll I tell my parents? Finally, he agreed.
"1 hour. I'll try my best.
I'll find a way."
"Thank you. Goodbye."
She paused for a moment. Just as Henry thought she might say something, she hung up. A sharp, chirpy female voice cut in on the line.
"The other party is disconnected. Would you like for me to assist you in another call?"
Henry hung up immediately, as if he'd been caught stealing. His mother was standing there when he turned around. She had a look Henry couldn't distinguish between curiosity and concern.
"What? You have a girlfriend, maybe?" she asked.
Henry shrugged and spoke in English.
"I don't know."
And truth be told, he didn't. If his mother thought it was odd that the little girl calling her son didn't speak Chinese, she didn't say anything. Maybe she thought all parents were forcing their children to speak their American. Who knew? Maybe they all were. Henry thought about how he'd get to Kobe Park, after hours, after blackout. He was glad he'd slept earlier. It was shaping up to be a very long night. Henry waited most of the hour in his room. It had been almost 9 o'clock when Keiko called. His parents had settled into bed around 9:30, not because they were particularly tired, but because going to bed early was the prudent thing to do. Saving electricity for the war effort was like a sacrament to Henry's father. After briefly listening and hearing no sign of his parents, Henry opened his window and crept down the fire escape. The ladder reached only halfway to the ground, but near enough to a closed dumpster for recycled tires. Henry removed his shoes and leapt for the dumpster, which made a muffled clanging as his stocking feet landed on the heavy metal lid. Getting up again would be a bit of a scramble, but doable, he thought, putting his shoes back on. As he walked along the damp sidewalks, his breath came out in a swirling mist, adding to the fog rolling in off the water. He tried to stay in the shadows, despite the fear that crept into his mind and curdled his stomach. Henry had never been out this late by himself, though with the crowds of people that bustled up and down the avenues, he hardly felt alone. All the way down South King, the street was awash in the stain of neon signs that defied the blackout restrictions. Signs for bars and nightclubs reflected greens and reds in each puddle he jumped over. The occasional car would drive by, bathing the street in its dim blue headlights, illuminating the men and women, Chinese and Caucasian, enjoying the nightlife, despite the rationing. Crossing 7th Avenue and entering Nihomachi was like stepping onto the dark side of the moon. No lights, no cars moving, everything locked down. Even the Manila restaurant had boards across its windows to protect them from vandals, despite being owned by Filipinos, not Japanese. The streets were empty all the way along Maynard Avenue. From the Janagi grocery to the Nippon Kan Hall, Henry saw no one, except for Keiko. At Kobe Park, across from the Kabuki Theater, he waved as he found her sitting on the hill, like last time, surrounded by a grove of cherry trees whose blossoms were beginning to bud. After walking up the steep hill of the terraced park, Henry caught his breath and sat on a rock beside her. She looked pale in the moonlight, shivering in the cold Seattle air.
"My parents made me stay home from school. They were afraid something might happen, that our family would be separated," she said.
Henry watched as she brushed her long hair out of her face. He was surprised at how peaceful she looked, how calm.
"The police and FBI came and took our radios, cameras, and a few people from our building. But then they left. We haven't seen them since." "I'm sorry."
It was all he could think of. What else could he say?
"They came and arrested scores of people back in December, right after Pearl Harbor. But it's been quiet for months now. Too quiet, I guess. Papa said the Navy has given up worrying about an invasion, and now they're more concerned about sabotage. You know, people blowing up bridges and power plants and stuff like that. So they swept through and arrested more Japanese."
Henry thought about the word sabotage. He'd sabotaged Mr. Preston's plans to buy up part of Japantown. Didn't feel bad about it either. But weren't these people taken away American? Japanese by descent, but American born? After all, Keiko's father had been born here.
"There's even a curfew now."
"Curfew?" Keiko nodded slowly, contemplating its effects as she looked around the barren streets.
"No Japanese are allowed outside of our neighborhoods from 8 o'clock at night to 6 in the morning. We're prisoners at night."
Henry shook his head, struggling to believe what she was saying, but knowing it must be true. From the arrests at the Black Elks Club to the victorious smile on his father's face, he knew it was really happening. He felt bad for Keiko and her family, for the wrongs done to everyone in Nihomachi. Yet he was so selfishly grateful to be with her, feeling guilty at his own happiness.
"I cut class today and went looking for you, he said. I was worried.
She looked at him, a small smile turning into a crooked grin. He felt nervous, stumbling over his words.
I was worried about school, Henry said. It's important that we don't fall behind, especially since the teachers don't pay attention to us very much anyway.
There was silence for a moment. Then they both heard the swing shift horn, blaring all the way from Boeing Field. Thousands of workers would be going home. Thousands more would be starting their day at 10 o'clock at night, making airplanes to fight in the war.
It's nice of you to care so much about my schooling, Henry.
He could see the disappointment in her eyes. The same look she'd had when they departed last night, after the arrests at the Black Elks Club.
I wasn't just worried about school, he admitted. It's more than that. I was worried about... It's okay, Henry. I don't mean to get you in trouble, either at school or at home with your father.
I'm not worried about my troubles. She looked at him and took a deep breath.
Good. 'Cause I need a favor, Henry. A big favor.
Keiko got up, and Henry followed her down the hill a bit, behind a bench where a red radio flyer wagon was partially hidden. In the back were stacks of photo albums and a box of prints.
These belong to my family. My mother told me to take them to the alley and burn them. She couldn't bring herself to do it. Her father was in the Japanese Navy. She wanted me to burn all her old photos from Japan.
Keiko looked at Henry with sad eyes.
I can't do it, Henry. I was hoping you might hide them for us. Just for a while. Can you do that for me?
Henry remembered the horrible scene in Japantown that afternoon. The photographer from the Ochi studio, visibly shaken, but determined.
I can hide them in my room. Do you have more? This is the important stuff. My mom's keepsakes. Family memories. The stuff we have from my baby years is okay for us to keep, I think. And some families in our neighborhood are trying to find someplace else to store things. Bigger things. We'll probably put other stuff there if we have to. I'll keep this safe. I promise.
Keiko hugged Henry for a brief moment. He found himself hugging her back. His hand touched her hair. She was warmer than Henry had imagined.
I need to get back before they know I'm gone, Keiko said. I guess I'll see you in school tomorrow?
Henry nodded, taking the handle of the little red wagon, heading for home, down the dark and empty streets of Japantown. Pulling behind him a lifetime of memories. Memories that he'd hide, and a secret he would keep, somewhere back home. Downhill, 1942. Henry knew just where he'd hide the photo albums when he got to his Canton Alley apartment. In that shallow, empty space between his lower dresser drawers and the floor below. Just enough room to stash all of Keiko's precious family photos, if he spread them out properly. He'd go up the fire escape and come back down with a pillowcase. It'd probably take 2 trips to bring everything up, but it shouldn't be any real trouble. My father snores, Henry thought, and my mother compensates by being a heavy sleeper. As long as I don't cause a racket, I should be able to pull it off without a hitch. Doing his best to stay in the shadows and zigzagging through darkened alleyways, Henry crept back toward Chinatown. A young boy out at night by himself might not normally draw that much attention, but with the blackout restrictions and the new curfew imposed on the Japanese, he would surely be stopped by any police officer patrolling the street. Through the darkness, Henry pulled the little red wagon, cargo and all, down Maynard Avenue, backtracking the way he'd come earlier. The streets in Japantown were barren. It felt empty, but safe. The wagon's back wheels squeaked and whined once in a while, piercing the quiet, peaceful evening. only a few more blocks. Then he'd be able to head north and down the hill into the heart of Chinatown and the direction of home. Still worrying about Keiko, Henry rolled past the Rodo Shaw publisher and the Yada Ladies tailor, with its Western-size, American-looking mannequins in the display window. Then he passed Eureka Dentistry, with its giant mottled tooth hanging outside, looking pale, almost transparent in the moonlight. If he could somehow block out the American flags and slogans that hung in every window, or were plastered on every boarded-up storefront, he could almost mistake this part of town for Chinatown, only bigger, more developed. As Henry left the quiet sanctuary of Japantown and warily headed north on South King in the direction of home, he saw someone, a boy. He could barely make out his shadow in the moonlight, backlit by the street lamps that buzzed and hummed, surrounded by moths bouncing off the glass. As Henry rolled closer, he could see the boy wiping down the poster of an American flag that had been posted over the window of the Janagi grocery. The door had a plank of plywood covering the glass near the doorknob, but the large windows were intact. Probably newly installed, Henry thought, covered with flags, serving as protectors. To Henry, it looked like the boy was painting, moving a brush over the surface of the paper. He's out at night, Henry thought, still doing his best to declare his citizenship, trying to protect his family's property. Henry relaxed for a moment, comforted that other kids his age were out at this hour. The young boy heard the squeaking of the wagon and froze. He turned away from his handiwork, stepping clear of the shadow to where Henry could see him, and likewise, he could see Henry. It was Denny Brown. In his hand was a paintbrush, dripping red paint all over the sidewalk, tear-shaped splotches trailing behind him.
"What are you doing here?"
he said. Henry could see a flicker of fear in Denny's eyes. He was scared, caught. Then Henry saw his startled, wide-eyed look change to anger when Denny's eyes narrowed with anticipation. Henry was all alone. There was no one else, and Denny seemed to know it, drawing closer, all while Henry looked on, stunned, holding the handle of Keiko's little red wagon.
"What are you doing?"
Henry asked, knowing the answer but needing to hear it from Denny himself. It was a vain attempt at understanding. He understood who, where, and what, but for the young life of him, he couldn't fathom why. Was it fear? Hatred? Or just youthful boredom that drove Denny here, to Japantown, where families hid and locked their doors, hiding their precious possessions, fearing arrest? While Denny stood on the corner painting, "Go Home, Japs," over American flags posted on store windows.
"I told you he was a Jap on the inside."
Henry knew the voice. Turning around, he saw Chaz, crowbar in one hand, and a wadded-up poster of an American flag in his other. A different kind of flag duty, Henry thought. The wooden door behind Chaz had long gashes where he'd scraped the poster off. Behind Chaz stood Carl Parks, another bully from school. The three converged on Henry. Looking around, Henry saw no one else, not a soul. Not even a light was visible from the nearby apartments. Chaz smiled.
"Taking your wagon out for a walk, Henry? What you got in there? You delivering some Jap newspapers? Or is that stuff a Japanese spy would be delivering?"
Henry looked down at Keiko's things, the photo albums, the wedding album, things he had promised to protect. He could barely stand up to one, let alone the three of them.
Without thinking, Henry slammed the handle of the radio flyer back into the wagon and took off running, pushing the wagon from behind.
He leaned his whole body into it as he ran, legs pumping the wagon up the crest of the hill and down the steep slope, down South King.
"Get him! Don't let that Jap lover get away!" Chaz shouted. "We're coming after you, Henry!"
he heard Denny shouting, his feet pounding the pavement. Henry didn't look back. As the wagon sped faster down the steep hill, Henry thought he'd fall face first into the sidewalk while it sped away. Instead, he jumped, like playing leapfrog on a moving playground. He flung his feet wide, knees out, as the seat of his pants landed in the back of the wagon, right on top of Keiko's photo albums. Legs splayed out, one on each side, the rubber of his shoes suspended over the ground as he flew along. Henry gripped the handle, steering as best he could. The wagon, cargo and all, careened down South King, rumbling on the cracked pavement. Henry could hear the shouts of the boys closing in behind him, giving chase. He briefly felt a hand on the back of his shirt, grasping at his collar. Henry leaned forward over the wagon handle, shifting his weight. Looking back for a moment, he saw his pursuers fall behind as he flew down the hill faster than a sled in wintertime. The squeaky wheels were now just a shimmering hum as the revolutions of the wagon's axles made a spinning noise like a top.
"Make way! Watch out! Move!"
Henry yelled as bar patrons wandering the streets skipped out of the way. He nearly clipped a man in overalls, but the racket was so loud and the scene before him so hysteric that most people jumped out of the way with plenty of time to spare. One woman dove into the open window of a parked car. Henry leaned back, slipping just beneath her wriggling stocking feet. He heard a clatter and a cry, and looked back to see Chaz and Carl skidding to a halt as Denny tumbled to the pavement face first. They'd given up their pursuit, far back up the hill. Henry turned around just in time to graze a parking meter. Jerking back on the handle, he lost what little control he had, ricocheting into the rear wheel of a car, slowly rolling through the intersection of South King and 7th Avenue. A police car. He'd slammed into the wheel and rear fender, a black slope of metal against the white chassis of the car. His shoes left black skid marks on the sidewalk as he slammed them down, trying to stop, wobbling and bouncing until his knees felt like two defective springs. Flying forward, Henry flipped over the handle, his side hitting, then bouncing off the white wall of the tire. The wagon tipped, spilling its contents alongside and underneath the car in a fan of loose photos and torn pages. Lying there in pain, Henry heard the brakes of the police car release and the engine idle into park. The pavement was cold and hard. His bruised body ached. His legs throbbed and his feet felt hot and swollen. People on the street regained their senses, some yelling, some cheering in what Henry figured must have been drunken celebration. The bullies from school had disappeared. Henry rolled to his hands and knees and slowly began scooping up the photos by the armload, dumping them back into the wagon. He looked over and saw the star-shaped emblem on the car door. Out stepped a uniformed patrol officer.
"Judas Priest! You're gonna get yourself killed pulling a stunt like that. At night, no less. If you had a little more horsepower in that thing, I might have run you over."
To Henry, he sounded more concerned than angry over the child-shaped projectile that had just torpedoed his cruiser. "But I was dead if I stayed behind," Henry thought, while trying to discreetly shuffle the last of the pictures and photo albums back into the wagon. He looked at the car. As far as he could tell in the dimly lit night, there was no damage. He'd blocked most of the impact with his own body as he flipped over the front end of the wagon. He was sporting a second skin of bruises and a knot on his head, but he'd be okay.
"I'm sorry. I was just trying to get home."
The officer picked up a photo that had slid partway under his patrol car. He examined it with his flashlight, then showed it to Henry. A dog-eared photo of a Japanese officer, posing beneath a white flag with a red sun, a sword at his side.
"And where is home, exactly? You know I could take you to jail for being out after curfew?"
Henry patted his shirt, finding the button, holding it out for the officer to see.
"I'm Chinese. A friend at school asked me..."
He couldn't think of what to say. The truth would have to do.
"A friend asked me to hold them. A Japanese-American family."
Spies and traitors came in all shapes and sizes, Henry prayed, but not as sixth graders out too late with a wagon load of photographs. The officer pawed through the mess of photos and flipped through the albums. No secret scouting shots of airplane hangars, no detailed photos of shipyards, just wedding photos, holiday photos, though many were in traditional Japanese dress. Henry squinted, blinded by the light the officer directed at his button, then straight at Henry. He couldn't see the officer, just a black shape with a silver badge.
"Where do you live?"
Henry pointed in the direction of Chinatown.
"South King?"
He was more worried about his father's reaction to a police officer bringing him home with a wagon load of Japanese photos than he was about going to jail. Jail would be a cakewalk by comparison. The officer looked more annoyed than offended. It was a busy night. Surely he had better things to do than run in a 12-year-old Chinese boy for reckless driving of a radio flyer.
"Go home, kid, and take this stuff with you. And don't let me catch you out after dark again, got it?"
Nodding vigorously, Henry shuffled off with the wagon in tow, his heart still pounding. He was only one block from home. He didn't look back. Within 15 minutes, Henry was in his room, sliding the bottom drawers of his dresser back in place. The Okabe's photo albums were safely hidden. He'd put the photos back in place as best he could. He could sort them out later. Keiko's wagon found a home beneath the stairs in the alley behind Henry's apartment building. He climbed into bed and kicked off the covers. Rubbing his head, he could feel the goose egg that had appeared. Hot and still sweaty from the running and scrambling, Henry left his bedroom window up, feeling the cool air come off the water. He could smell the rain that would be coming soon, and hear the horns and bells of the ferries along the waterfront, signaling their last run for the night. And in the distance, he could hear swing jazz being played somewhere. Maybe even the Black Elks Club. T. 1986. Henry looked up from his paper, smiling as he saw Marty and his fiancée, Samantha, waving in the window. They entered the tiny storefront cafe that sat at the base of the Panama Hotel, their entrance ringing with a string of Buddhist bells that jangled from the front door.
"Since when did you start hanging out in Japanese tea houses?" Marty asked, holding out a black wicker chair for Samantha.
Henry folded his paper nonchalantly.
"I'm a regular." "Since when?" Marty asked, more than surprised.
"Since last week."
"You must be turning over a whole new tea leaf, then. This is all news to me."
Marty turned to Samantha.
"Pops would never, ever come here. In fact, he hated coming over to this side of town, pretty much from here to Kobe Park, outside that new theater, the Nippon Kan Theater,
Henry corrected.
"Right, that place. I used to accuse Pops of being a nippophobe, someone that was afraid of all things Japanese."
As he said it, Marty waved his hands in mock fright.
"Why?"
Samantha asked, in a way that made it seem she thought Marty was joking or teasing. The waitress brought a fresh pot of tea, and Marty refilled his father's cup and poured a cup for Samantha. Henry, in turn, filled Marty's. It was a tradition Henry cherished, never filling your own cup, always filling that of someone else, who would return the favor.
"Pop's Pop, my grandfather, was a crazy traditionalist. He was like a Chinese Farrakhan. But he was famous around here. He raised money to fight the Japanese back home. You know, during the whole war in the Pacific, he was helping the war efforts in northern China. It was a big deal back then, huh, Pops?"
"That is an understatement," Henry said, slurping his tea, holding the small cup with both hands.
"Growing up, Pops was never allowed in Japantown. It was verboten. If he came home smelling of wasabi, he'd be kicked out of the house or some craziness like that."
Samantha looked intrigued.
"Is that why you never came here? Or to Japantown? Because of your father?"
Henry nodded.
"It was a different time back then. Around 1882, the Chinese Exclusion Act was passed by Congress. No more Chinese were allowed to immigrate. This was when competition for jobs was fierce. Chinese laborers, like my father, were used to working harder for less. So much so that when the local fisheries added canning machines,
Those machines were called iron chinks. But still, the local businesses needed cheap labor, so they went around the Exclusion Act. They allowed Japanese workers to come over. Not just workers, but picture brides, too. Japantown flourished, while Chinatown remained stagnant. My father resented that. And when Japan invaded China... But what about afterwards? She asked. After you were grown up, after he passed away. Did you feel like all bets were off and you could run wild if you wanted to? Man, I would. Being told I can't have something would just drive me crazy, even if I didn't know what to do with it in the first place. Henry looked at his son, who was waiting for an answer to a question even he had never asked. When I was a little boy, most of the International District was Japantown, or Nihomachi, as they called it then. So it was a big place that my father forbade me to enter. It had a, Henry searched for the word, a mystique about it. And over the years, much of it changed. At the time, it was illegal to sell property to non-whites, except in certain areas. There were even districts for Italian immigrants, Jewish people, black people. That's just the way it was. So after the Japanese were taken away, all these other people moved in. It was like wanting to go into a certain bar to have a drink. But by the time you turn 21, the bar has turned into a flower shop. It just wasn't the same. So you didn't want to go? Marty asked. After all those years of being told not to, when you finally had your chance, you still didn't want to wander over just to see? Henry poured more tea for Samantha, furrowing his brow. Oh, I didn't say that. But you said it changed. It did. But I still wanted to go. Then why didn't you? Why now? Samantha asked. Henry finally pushed his teacup away, drumming his fingers on the glass tabletop. He let out a heavy sigh, one that seemed to reveal a part of him, like a curtain drawing back from a darkened stage that was slowly coming to life. The reason I never went to Nihomachi is because it was too painful to do so. Henry felt his eyes gloss with wetness, but not quite tears. There was a moment of silence. Another customer left the tea room. The door chimes rang again, breaking the pregnant pause between them. I don't get it. Why would it be painful if you never went there in the first place, if your father forbade it? Samantha asked, before Marty could. Henry looked at the two of them, so young, so handsome together, but so much they didn't know. Yes, my father forbade it, he sighed, staring longingly at the framed photos of Nihomachi that hung on the walls. He was vehemently against all things Japanese. Even before Pearl Harbor, the war in China had been going on for almost 10 years. For his son to be frequenting that other part of town, Japantown, would have been bad form. Shameful to him. But oh, how I went. I went anyway, despite him. I went deep into the heart of Nihomachi. Right here, where we sit now, this was all Japantown. I went and saw many things. In many ways, the best and worst times of my life were spent on this very street. Henry could see the confusion in his son's eyes, more like shock, really. Marty had grown up all these years, assuming Henry was like his grandfather. A zealous man, passionate about the old ways and the old country. Someone who harbored enmity toward his neighbors, especially the Japanese ones. Clinging to leftover feelings from the war years. It never dawned on his son that Henry's steeped passion for tradition, his stodgy old-world habits, could be for any other reason. "Is this why you invited us here for tea?" Marty asked. The impatience in his voice seemed to soften. "To tell us about Japantown?" Henry nodded yes, then said, "No," correcting himself. "Actually, I'm glad Samantha asked, because it certainly makes the rest of this easier to explain." "The rest of what?" Marty asked. Henry recognized the look in his son's eyes. It reminded him of the halting, half-spoken conversations he'd had with his own father all those years ago.
"I could use your help."
"In the basement." Henry stood up and took out his wallet. He put a $10 bill on the table to cover the tea, then walked up the steps connecting the tea room to the hotel lobby, which was still under renovation. "Are you coming?"
"Coming where?" Marty asked.
Samantha took his arm and pulled him along, his confusion mirrored by her excitement and anticipation.
"I'll explain when we get there," Henry said with a subdued smile.
Together, they went through the frosted Art Deco doors into the glowing lobby of the Panama Hotel. It smelled of dust and mold, but felt new, as Henry touched the brick, where it had just been sandblasted and sealed, stripping away decades of chipped paint and dust. Swept and clean, and swept again. It was just as Henry remembered from when he was a boy, peering through the ornate window. The hotel was the same all over again, as if nothing had changed. Maybe he hadn't changed that much either. Henry, Marty, and Samantha stopped in at the makeshift office of the Panama Hotel and waved a hello to Miss Pedersen, who was on the phone, negotiating with a builder or a contractor. She had plans spread across her desk and was discussing details of the renovation. Something about not wanting to change, about wanting to restore the hotel to the way it was. Apparently, buildings like this were either torn down or turned into high-priced condominiums. From the few conversations Henry had had with Miss Pedersen, he knew she was having nothing of it. She wanted to restore the Panama Hotel to its former glory, retaining as much of the original architecture as possible. The marble cento baths, the simple rooms, much the same way she'd restored the tea house. Henry signed in, whispering,
"We'll be in the basement. I brought help this time," pointing to his son and soon-to-be daughter-in-law.
She nodded and waved them on as she kept talking on the phone. Heading down the old stairwell, Marty was getting impatient again.
Where exactly are we going, Pops?
Henry kept telling him,
"Wait and see. Wait and see."
Through the heavy, rust-hinged door, Henry led them into the basement storage room. He flipped the light switch, and the makeshift string of utility lights crackled to life.
"What is this place?" Samantha asked, running her hands along the dusty stacks of suitcases and old boxes.
"This is a museum, I think. It just doesn't know it yet. Right now, it's sort of a time capsule. From before you were born," Henry said. "During the war, the Japanese community was evacuated. For their own safety, supposedly. They were given only a few days' notice, and were forced inland to internment camps. A senator at the time, I think he was from Idaho, called them concentration camps. They weren't that bad, but it changed the lives of many. People had to leave everything behind. They could take only two suitcases each and one small sea bag, like a duffel bag." Henry approximated the size with his hands. "So they stored their valuable belongings in places like this hotel, the basements of churches, or with friends. What was left in their homes was long gone by the time they returned. Looters took everything. But most didn't return anyway."
"And you saw all this, didn't you? When you were a boy?" Marty asked.
"I lived it," Henry said. "My father was for the evacuation. He was excited about E-Day, as many called it. I didn't understand it completely, but I was caught in the middle of everything, I saw it all happen.
So that's why you never came back to Japantown? Just too many bad memories? Marty asked.
Something like that, Henry said. In a way, there was nothing for me to come back to. It was all gone.
But I don't get it. Why is this stuff still here? Samantha asked.
This hotel was boarded up with the rest of Japantown. The owner himself was taken away. People lost everything. Japanese banks closed. Most people didn't come back. I think the hotel changed owners a few times, but it stayed boarded up all these years. Decades, in fact. Miss Pedersen bought it and found all of this still here. Unclaimed. She's trying to find the owners. My guess is that there are things here belonging to 30 or 40 families. She waits for contact, someone to come forward and claim, but very few have.
There's no one left alive?
40 years is a long time, Henry explained. People have moved on. Or passed on, I'm afraid. They looked at the stacks of luggage in silence. Samantha touched the thick cloak of dust on a cracked leather steamer trunk.
Pops, this is fascinating, but why are you showing us this?
Marty still looked a little confused, eyeing the rows of boxes piled to the ceiling.
Is this what you really brought us here for?
For Henry, it was as if he had stumbled into some unseen room in the house he had grown up in, revealing a part of his past Marty never knew existed.
Well, I asked you to come here because I could use your help, looking for something.
Henry looked at Marty, seeing the dim ceiling lights flicker in his son's eyes.
Let me guess, an old forgotten Oscar Holden record? One that supposedly doesn't exist anymore. You think you're going to find one here in all this stuff from, what, 45 years ago?
Maybe.
I didn't know Oscar Holden made an album, Samantha said. That's been Pop's holy grail. Rumor is they printed a handful back in the 40s, but none survived today, Marty explained. Some people don't even believe it ever actually existed, because when Oscar died, he was so old even he didn't remember recording it. Just some of his bandmates and, of course, Pop's here.
I bought it. I know it existed, Henry interrupted. But my parents' old Victrola wouldn't play it.
So where is it now, the one you bought? Samantha asked, prying the lid off an old hatbox, wrinkling her nose at the musty smell.
Oh, I gave it away. Long time ago. I never even listened to it.
That's so sad, she said.
Henry just shrugged.
So you think one might be in here, among all these boxes? One might have survived all these years?
That's what I'm here to find out, Henry said.
And if so, who did it belong to? Marty interrupted, wondering. Someone you knew, Pops? Someone your old man didn't want you hanging out with on the wrong side of town?
Maybe, Henry offered. Find it, and I'll tell you.
Marty looked at his father, and the mountains of boxes, crates, trunks, and suitcases.
Samantha squeezed Marty's hand for a moment, smiling.
Then I guess we'd better get started, she said.
Records, 1942. When Henry told Keiko about his wild ride down South King the night before, she burst out laughing. She searched the lunch line and giggled almost as hard when she saw Denny Brown appear. He wore a defeated scowl, like an angry whipped mutt. His cheeks and nose were scabbed over from where his face had skidded along the pavement after his fall. Denny disappeared into the herd of hungry kids. They stampeded by, making their normal, abnormal faces, as Henry and Keiko dished up a gray mess that Mrs. Beatty soberly called Spam a la King. The bubbling sauce had a subtle green tint to it, almost metallic in its sheen, glossy like a fish's eyeball. All week long, they scraped out the empty steamer trays and dumped the leftovers in the garbage. Mrs. Beatty didn't believe in saving leftovers. Ordinarily, she had Henry and Keiko place the food scraps in separate buckets, to be retrieved by local pig farmers, who used the dregs as slop each night. This time, though, the leftovers went in the regular garbage cans. Even pigs have standards. By Monday, lunch was back to the same routine. In the storage room, Henry and Keiko sat on a pair of upturned milk crates, splitting a can of peaches, and talking about what had happened at the Black Elks Club the night that Keiko's English teachers had been arrested, and how the curfews were affecting everyone. The papers didn't say much. What they did say about the arrests got lost in the big headline of the week, that General MacArthur had miraculously escaped the Philippines, proclaiming, "I came out of Bataan, and I shall return." Buried beneath that news was a small column about the arrest of suspected enemy agents. Maybe that was what Henry's father had been talking about. The conflict that had seemed so far away suddenly felt closer than ever. Especially with bullies like Chaz, Carl Parks, and Denny Brown still out there waging war on the playground. Even though no one ever wanted to be the Japs or the Jerrys, they usually made some little kid play the enemy, hounding him mercilessly. If they ever got tired of it, Henry never saw it. But here in this dusty storage closet, there was shelter and company. Keiko smiled at Henry. "I have a surprise for you," she said. He looked at her expectantly, offering the last peach, which she speared with a fork and ate in two big bites. They shared drinks of the sweet, syrupy juice that was left. "It's a surprise, but I'm not going to show it to you until after school." It wasn't his birthday, and Christmas had been months ago. Still, a surprise was a surprise. "Is this because I'm storing all your photographs? If so, no need. I'm happy to." Keiko cut him off. "No, this is for taking me to the Black Elks Club with you." "And almost getting us thrown in jail," Henry muttered sheepishly. He watched her purse her lips and consider that comment, then dismiss his concern, beaming at Henry. "It was worth it." Together they enjoyed a moment of silence that was interrupted by a knock on the half-open door. Scientific proof that time sometimes passes all too quickly. "Shoo, fly, shoo!" That was Mrs. Beatty's way of telling them to get a move on. Time to get back to their classes. After lunch, she usually thundered back into the kitchen, working her teeth with a fresh toothpick, sometimes holding a copy of Life magazine, rolled up like a billy club or a fish bat. She used it to swat flies, which she left lying there, their flattened guts smeared on the metal kitchen counters. Henry held the door for Keiko, who let her hair down and headed back to her classroom. Henry followed, looking back as Mrs. Beatty settled in with her magazine. It was last week's issue. The cover read, "Bathing Suits in Fashion." After school, they pounded erasers, wiped desks, and mopped the bathrooms. Henry kept asking about Keiko's surprise. She coyly deferred.
"Later. I'll show you on the way home."
Instead of walking south toward Nihomachi, Keiko led him north, to the heart of downtown Seattle. Every time Henry asked where they were going, she'd just point to the massive Rhodes department store on 2nd Avenue. Henry had been there a few times with his parents, only on those special occasions when they needed something important, or something that couldn't be found in Chinatown. Rhodes was a local favorite. Being in the massive six-story building was like taking a life-size stroll through the Sears catalog, but with a certain charm and real-world grandeur, especially with its massive pipe organ, which was played during lunchtime and dinner, special concerts for hungry shoppers. At least it had been until a few months ago, when the organ had been dismantled and moved to the new Civic Ice Arena over on Mercer. Henry followed Keiko to the audio section, a corner on the second floor with cabinet radios and phonographs. There was an aisle with long cedar racks of disc records, which to Henry felt lighter and more fragile than shellac records. Shellac supplies had been limited, apparently, another conscript of the war effort, so vinyl was now being used for the latest hit music, like String of Pearls by Glenn Miller and Artie Shaw's Stardust. Henry loved music, but his parents had only an old Victrola. I doubt